The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
The mother of all bombs, the massive ordnance air blast munition, is about 30 feet long and weighs more than 11 tons. It's a fuel air bomb, meaning that it works by spreading a cloud of flammable gas and then igniting it. United States troops dropped an older style of these fuel air bombs during the Vietnam War in order to flatten large areas of forest for helicopter landing zones. And then the Bush administration dropped at least one of the Daisy Cutters, a Moab precursor, back during his fight against the Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. Now, this gas, it spreads into bunkers and even underground as well, and the fuel air weapon can also collapse fortifications and these tunnel networks because of that at a radius potentially of hundreds of yards, that is, underground. One Russian military scientist wrote in the Russian trade journal Military Knowledge that, quote, in its destructive capability, it is comparable to low-yield nuclear munitions. If used on the surface, it's capable of leveling 5 or 6 city blocks all at once. It has a radius of destruction of about 0.5 miles. That makes a full mile across of destruction. Now, the Pentagon rushed the development of the Moab, which is known as the mother of all bombs, in early 2003 in order for the weapon to be ready for the invasion of Iraq. But the Moabs proved either unnecessary or way too risky for use in Iraq's densely populated areas. So the Moabs remained in storage, at least until last Thursday, when they were used. Welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I'm Brent Nachtigall, filling in for Stephen Flory today. We're coming to you from Edstone, England, and this is broadcast, of course, back in Edmond, Oklahoma, on 101.3 FM and streaming online, kpcg.fm or thetrumpet.com. And this is, of course, what happened on Thursday. I'm talking about the use of the Moab in northeastern Afghanistan by the Trump administration, in this same area that one of these Daisy Cutters was used before under President Bush. This time, this Moab, the largest of all bombs, short of a nuclear bomb, was used for the first time in warfare back on April 13th. This is how the Daily Beast reported its use. United States Special Operations Forces dropped one of the world's most powerful non-nuclear bombs on ISIS fighters in eastern Afghanistan on April 13th. The bombing could mark a shocking escalation of America's war in Afghanistan, one that places more civilians in greater danger than ever before, though the military officials insist they wouldn't have acted if they had spotted civilians nearby. You see, this bomb is so dangerous that it can't be used in any type of city situation or any type of genuine insurgency when you're fighting terrorist groups that are embedded in local populations, because it just destroys, it flattens. But if there's an area where you know that there are just terrorists, in this case, ISIS has about 600 to 800 fighters in Afghanistan, many of them in this territory where this bomb was used, then you can go for it. The Daily Beast continued, American forces were trying to root out deeply entrenched ISIS fighters when a U.S. Air Force MC-130 commando transport dropped the massive ordnance air blast munition in Aachen district in Nangarhar province in eastern Afghanistan at 7:32 in the evening local time. One U.S. commando died in a firefight in the same district just a few days ago on April 8th, but officials say this act was not retribution. Even so, they dropped it. They dropped it and so have entered a new era of war where this bomb is able to be used. No, it's not a nuclear warhead. And yet the destructive capacity of this bomb is unmatched. Unmatched. And so they dropped it. This was planned. Now, granted, this was an important structure to hit. And by structure, I mean this mountain. This was a huge underground tunnel system or complex or cave system. This is the same one that Osama bin Laden used to hide in before he stole away to Pakistan back in 2001. It's capable of holding 1,000 men, and it's a complex that's inside a 13,000-foot mountain. Inside this complex is even a hydroelectric generator that uses nearby mountain streams, and the power that it generates runs the lighting, the air ventilation system, along, of course, with the power necessary for weapons and reconnaissance work through various technological means. There's also a weapons facility inside as well. So this was a worthy target. But why use the Moab? Why use the mother of all bombs? And why now? Now, David Hamburg, he's an independent munitions expert, he said that in dropping the Moab, the military was hoping for, quote, a combination of psychological and kinetic effects. Now, Hambling, when he was talking to the Daily Beast, he said it's not the obvious weapon of choice to destroy a cave complex. It may generate a massive overpressure causing lethal effects to some depths, but it's much less obvious use as a cave-destroying weapon than the smaller thermobaric BLU-128. I don't know what that is, but I trust him. He says that is designed to take out tunnels and caves with blast. And yet, they use this one, the mother of all bombs. Now, within hours of the bombing, the Defense Department then posted a press release describing the attack and its alleged effect on ISIS positions. Quote, "This is the right munition to reduce these obstacles and maintain the momentum of our offensive." Then it says, or at least this was tweeted by the Council of Foreign Relations, Mika Zenko. He quipped on Twitter, "Of the 12,000 bombs the U.S. dropped on Afghanistan in the past 5 years, Moab is the first to be honored with its own press release." So obviously this is more than just the targeting of ISIS in the eastern parts of Afghanistan. Of course, that's a worthy target again. But why use the Moab? Was it because of the psychological effect it would have, not just on those ISIS fighters? I think the total is about 40 that it killed, or even the destruction of part of this cave complex. Was Mr. Trump using this, or the generals he claims have the power to use this without his approval? Nevertheless, it was used, and why now? The Wall Street Journal had an editorial out on Thursday about this, or it might have been Friday morning. It says this, as demonstration effects go, it would be hard to top the bomb the U.S. dropped on Thursday on Islamic State in Afghanistan. The 21,000-pound mother of all bombs landed on an Islamic State installations in eastern Afghanistan. What happened at the receiving end of the bomb isn't known, nor would White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer say whether Mr. Trump personally gave authorization, which isn't really needed to deploy the bomb. But then it says, but like the 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles that struck a Syrian airbase last week, the right people no doubt noticed this display of American purpose. So the Wall Street Journal thinks it wasn't just a tactical decision on ISIS to use the mother of all bombs. There were obviously others out there intended to take notice of this from the American government, this use of this bomb. At the top of that list, I'll continue with the Wall Street Journal, would be Islamic State, which Mr. Trump has promised to eliminate. The terrorist group has seized territory in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province near the border with Pakistan. The Afghan army, supported by the United States, has taken significant losses in the attempt to dislodge ISIS. And then the commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, General John Nicholson, called the mother of all bombs the right munition to maintain momentum against ISIS. And as this Wall Street Journal article continues, it says momentum is an important concept in this fight. The armed forces of Iraq, for example, are on the brink of recovering Mosul from Islamic State and have taken huge casualties to do so. But it will be difficult to consolidate an achievement like that unless other nations are willing to make similar commitments to support the fight, whether in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, or Yemen. Momentum routinely wilts beneath the politics and factions across the Middle East. The strike against Syria, and now the use by America, it's saying, and now the use in Afghanistan of the biggest non-nuclear bomb in the active U.S. arsenal makes clear America's resolve to our allies. And the Islamic State won't be defeated without buy-in from those allies. Saying, in order for the United States to have the momentum necessary to garner allies in its fight against the Islamic State, this weapon was a sign. This weapon was a sign that America is committed to that fight. Now. Wall Street Journal continues, we may also assume that the missile launching crowd in Pyongyang, that is the capital of North Korea, noticed the deployment of the mother of all bombs. Far be it from us to suggest that the U.S. drop one bomb on a North Korean nuclear factory, but in the space of a week, Kim Jong-un, Vladimir Putin, Bashar Assad, Xi Jinping, and ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, wherever he is hiding, have learned that the United States considers it to be in its interest to push back hard against its adversary's aggression. And that's where it ends. This is a sign. If you couple the use of the mother of all bombs, along with the 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles that the United States fired from the Eastern Mediterranean to the Syrian airstrip from which Assad fired on his own people or led planes to be take off and drop those chemical weapons on his own people. Those two U.S. attacks are a sign. And according to a number of conservative commentators, they're a sign the United States is back. The United States is back. Now, this is what Charles Krauthammer wrote in his column this week. I'm going to quote it at length, but if you're listening to this online, then you can access this article as well. I'll leave the link in the show notes below. He says, in foreign policy as elsewhere, Trump is not afraid to change his mind. The world is agog at Donald Trump's head-snapping foreign policy reversal. He runs on a platform of America first. He renounces the role of the world policeman. He excoriates parasitic foreigners, that I paraphrase, suck dry our precious bodily fluids, and these are allies. On April 4th, Trump declared, quote, I don't want to be president of the world. I am the president of the United States. And from now on, it's going to be America first. A week earlier than that, both his Secretary of State and his UN ambassador said that the regime of Bashar Assad is a reality and that changing it is no longer an American priority. Then last week, Mr. Krauthammer writes, Assad drops chemical weapons on the rebel-held territory and Trump launches 49 Tomahawk missiles into Syria. This was in part an emotional reaction to images of children dying of sarin poisoning and in part seizing the opportunity to redeem Barack Obama's unenforced red line on chemical weapons. Whatever the reason, moral or strategic, Trump acted and effectively reset his entire foreign policy. That's what happened when he agreed to launch those 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles. And what we're seeing with the use of the mother of all bomb is a consolidation of Mr. Trump behind his new foreign policy. Then Krauthammer writes, true, in and of itself, the raid will not decisively alter the course of Syria's civil war. Assad and his Iranian, Russian, and Hezbollah co-combatants still have the upper hand, but no longer a free hand. After 6 years of U.S. passivity, there are now limits, and America will enforce them. Nor was the raid the beginning of a campaign for regime change. It was, however, Krauthammer writes, a reassertion of an American stake in both the conduct and the outcome of the war. America's abdication is over. Be warned. Be warned, world. America is back. They're my words I'm tacking on, but really I'm quoting Krauthammer because that's what he says at the very end of this article. He writes again, "Moreover, the very swiftness of the response carried a message to the wider world. Obama is gone. No more elaborate forensic investigations. No agonized presidential hand-wringing over the moral dilemmas of a fallen world. It took Obama 10 months to decide what to do in Afghanistan. It took Trump 63 hours to make Assad pay for his chemical weapons duplicity. America demonstrated its capacity for swift, decisive action." And indeed they did. Indeed they did, and it was a worthy target. But then he continues, "And in defense, mind you, of an abstract international norm, a rationale that dramatically overrides the constraints of America first, that strike sent a message to both China and North Korea that Trump's threats of unilateral action against Pyongyang's nukes and missiles are serious. Now that he has fired on Syria, now his threats can be taken seriously." And interestingly enough, through this, he talks about the use of these weapons as a dramatic sea change from what we've experienced for the previous 8 years. And indeed it is. And yet you get the sense that Mr. Krauthammer, along with other conservatives we'll talk about today, or just a few of them, are practically giddy that America is back. And apparently all it took were 59 cruise missiles, Tomahawk cruise missiles, and then added to that the use of the mother of all bombs. And now the world is back to where it should be, with America at the forefront, with America leading the way, with America that is, well, that feels more comfortable acting in the international scene. And really, the actions of America for the past 50 or 60 years have been the main constraint on wicked and evil world powers from clutching at more power. Well, they've tried to clutch at it, but the United States was there, and its threats were taken seriously. 8 years ago, or for the past 8 years, numerous threats went without significant follow-up, and therefore we saw nations all over the world, evil empires, grow in power. And yet, what we're seeing over the actions over the past 3 weeks is maybe the American deterrent factor is back. Now, Mr. Krauthammer concludes his article this way. "We've just witnessed one about face. With a president who counts unpredictability as a virtue, he could, of course, reverse again. For now, however, the traditionalists are in the saddle. U.S. policy has been normalized. The world is on notice. 8 years of sleepwalking is over. America is back. America is back." And apparently all it took were a couple of these military actions. That was Mr. Krauthammer talking. He no doubtably, as a realist, as being fed up of 8 years of Mr. Obama's rule, is somewhat happy right now, it seems. America of old is back. America that will stand up to the world. America that will maintain order. I mean, the giddiness over these just two actions in the past week by American conservatives is absolutely astounding. It's astounding that they believe that the course of the past 8 years has been rectified, and that the world is now on notice, and that we are finally again going to see an American resurgence. They're hopeful of an American resurgence, and I don't blame them for being hopeful of that at all. But is it true? Is America back? Is America back on the scene? Will America fulfill its longstanding duties to the world that it's fulfilled as being the policeman of the world? Is America great again? Well, this is how Mark Stein on Fox News describes his reaction to the Syrian Tomahawk cruise missiles.
How are foreign capitals, especially our enemies, Moscow, elsewhere, how they're waking up this morning? Obviously, it's already midday over there. What's their calculation, their next step?
Well, I think they understand that this is really inauguration. Last night was inauguration day. That America is back in the world.
And that was Mark Stein speaking on Fox and Friends, and apparently America is back in the world. Those 559 Tomahawk cruise missiles, they were inauguration day. This is a brand new America. Now, really? Is this really the case? Is America back? Now, it really does give you an idea of how far America has fallen over the past 8 years under President Obama, that all it takes is a couple of extremely targeted and relatively small strikes on two absolute no-brainer targets that conservatives are now shouting that America is back. Now, I mean, if you talk about this attack of the 59 cruise missiles against an airstrip that these planes were fired from, or these planes, sorry, launched from or took off from, carrying the chemical weapons. I mean, there was six of Assad's forces that are gone. And wow, the rejoicing that takes place after an airbase was struck. A runway or two was struck. A couple of planes were struck. And then this attack, dropping the mother of all bombs, even though it is highly symbolic, the fact that it targeted ISIS in a cave network that Osama bin Laden used was hardly a controversial location to use it. And yet, apparently, America is back, just from using those two strikes. Now, allies around the world, they are rejoicing as well. This is from The Spectator in Australia, David Flint, writing this week. He said, President Trump could follow the precedent set by the Obama administration, not only in relation to Syria, but also in relation to Iran. Instead, he decided to act. The fact is that America, the great, benign, and civilized leader of the West, sharing our principles and values, is back. America is back. The free world, he writes, should not only be relieved, we should rejoice. We should rejoice. And that's how he concludes his article. Again, that was from The Spectator in Australia. Really, though, we should ask the question, is America back? What America are they talking about? What America? Are they talking about the America that hasn't successfully finished a war since World War II? The America that failed in Vietnam, failed in Afghanistan, has failed in Iraq, that failed in Libya? Is that the America that is back? Maybe they're referring to the America that's unafraid to use the big stick that it has. And again, America has done absolutely wonderful things for the world and has largely, through the threat of its force, though it has chosen incorrect policies in its wars and how it has fought its wars and who its enemies really are, it has had a deterring effect on the evil powers of this world. But before we start really rejoicing that America is back, let's just remember that these were two of the least controversial targets possible. Even most left-wingers in the EU and even in the United States, liberals agreed that these actions were necessary and appropriate. It's hardly a return or announcing a return to a robust foreign policy. It's just that the previous 8 years were so bad that any attack on foreign soil seems like a massive achievement when really these were really obvious targets that most people in the world agree with. Now, while I agree that these attacks really were a breath of fresh air, they were only a few Tomahawk missiles fired at an empty airstrip and a bomb targeting a base where ISIS was. Are those really going to deter Putin's Russia or Xi's China or the Ayatollah's Iran? Are those acts, those extremely targeted acts, really going to deter those rising powers on the Earth scene? Well, probably not. And the bigger question is this something that we should be putting trust in? Is this something that we should be rejoicing about, that America is back? Surely we should ask the question, is America back? Do these two signals make a strong enough case that America is back and that America will stand up to the likes of Putin, to the likes again of Xi, to the likes again of the Ayatollah? Well, that is most definitely yet to be seen. Now, they were, again, definitely actions that do show America's ability, if it has the will to use its power. Now, those attacks most definitely do show that the United States still is the supreme military in this on this planet, and it still is able, if it has the will, if it has the strength, to use the amazing military at its disposal. But when we come back, we're going to see that the Bible has a different estimation of American power. American power, again, has to be multiplied by the will to use it. Again, you could argue, as these commentators are, that America is back because it's shown that it has the will to use it. Well, again, let's just look at the targets. They were the most incontroversial targets absolutely possible. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, we're going to look into the Bible and see just exactly what God says about America's current state of will and the strength of its military power. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Again, I'm Brent Nachtigall, filling in for Stephen Flurry, and we're talking about the two targeted strikes, one in Syria and one in Afghanistan, by the Trump administration, and what it means of a resurgent America, or asking the question, is America back, like numerous conservative commentators believe? Well, as you know, we at The Trumpet, we look into the Bible for our answers, especially when it comes to biblical prophecy, the events of the end time. But we also look into the Bible for absolute principles of life. And many of these principles of life concern the military power, or the power that one nation has over another nation. And especially when it comes to the nations of Israel, of which the United States is one. And if you want to prove that, you can request our booklet, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. But when it comes to Israel, there are a number of laws that are in effect when it comes to how strong the military is going to be, or how strong the fighting force will be, or how strong the will of the people is going to be. And what we see in there is that will, or strength to use the power that America has been given as a blessing that it was given because of the blessings of Abraham, Israel's forefather. They were given that power, and yet they're only going to use that power when they are obedient. They're only going to find strength in that power. They're only going to have the will to use that power, and it's only going to accomplish something if they're obedient. Obedient to what? Obedient to God's laws. Now consider this. To the ancient nation of Israel, God promised manifold blessings for obedience to his laws. And among them was a promise of security through supernatural protection. I'm going to quote here Leviticus chapter 26, verse 6 to 8. And this is, as Mr. Armstrong called it, one of the most crucial, pivotal chapters in prophecy in the Old Testament. Leviticus 26, verse 6 to 8 says this, "And I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid, neither shall the sword go through your land. And you shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword. And five of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword." Now, clearly, the United States isn't really receiving this blessing today. Now, the counterpart to the promised blessing of victory here over enemies is God's warning of terrifying curses for disobedience. Now, the idea, again, of being under a curse, that might seem ancient, superstitious, foolish, especially in our modern scientific age when we're dropping bombs. But the bomb, again, it was called Moab, Moab for short, which isn't is even a biblical nation. Nevertheless, if you believe your Bible, you know that curses are real even today. And to rebellious Israel and its descendants, which includes the United States, God warns, "I will break the pride of your power, and your strength shall be spent in vain." So God is saying here that obedience leads to military victory. Disobedience leads to the curse of maybe having strength, but spending it in vain, not accomplishing anything on the world scene. And maybe it was easy to say that, well, it was easy to point to those scriptures and say that was being fulfilled under the tenure of Mr. Obama. We had a lot of strength then. It was spent in vain. And then how we have Mr. Trump. And yet, can we claim that our strength is back? The United States' strength is back? Well, ask yourself this. Did the American population turn righteous in January this year when Mr. Trump came into office? Those two are directly connected. Now, there might be some political ramifications of this couple of acts, and there might be a few more of them. But in the end, the strength of the United States is directly proportional to its righteousness level. And there hasn't been a dramatic change when Mr. Trump comes office in the righteousness of America. And therefore, this prophecy is going to come to pass and is coming to pass. America's strength will be spent in vain. Again, there might be a temporary reprieve here because there is a leader that is actually willing to act in some fashion, which is directly opposed or different to the previous administration. But fundamentally, there's been no change in the righteousness of the people. And therefore, America's strength will be spent in vain again. America isn't back. As you've learned on this program, America's blessings and its military power were purely the result of one man's obedience thousands of years ago and God having to fulfill his promise to Abraham and it's to his descendants to give the material blessings that he promised all the way back in the book of Genesis and reconfirmed to Isaac and Israel or Jacob. They had to be given if God was to keep his word. And they were given to the United States and they were given to Britain. Again, that's proven in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. But once they were given, they could then be taken away. And that is what we are seeing, regardless of the president in the Oval Office. Now we're going to take one more short break, and when we return, we're going to look at an example of when the army of America's forefathers faced an enemy that far outmatched them in magnitude, and yet where they turned to for help. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Revelation 6 stands out as an important chapter because of how it locks in with another one of Jesus Christ's prophecies. The glorified Christ revealed these future events to John in Revelation 6, and it was Jesus Christ as a human being, God in the flesh, who prophesied these same events in Matthew 24, the same Christ. In the traditional Christian world, we hear a lot about Christ as our sacrifice, our Savior. But how about Jesus Christ the prophet? That's exactly what he was. His gospel and his whole message revolved around prophecy. So to know Christ means to know about the prophecies he spoke in Revelation and in Matthew. This free booklet, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, shows that what Christ prophesied in Matthew 24 is primarily for the end time. For more than five decades, Herbert W. Armstrong declared a powerful and consistent warning about the dramatic fulfillment of end-time prophecy. Using the Bible as his guide, Mr. Armstrong made bold predictions about the course of world events long before they occurred. He Was Right encapsulates what he boldly proclaimed for more than 50 years. This free booklet will build your faith in the certainty of biblical prophecy. Request He Was Right and The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Both booklets are offered free of charge at no cost or obligation to you. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Again, this is coming to you on this Monday, where I'm recording it actually before Monday, because it is the last day of Unleavened Bread. And this last day, or the days of Unleavened Bread, obviously picture the time when Israel was led out of Egypt in their exodus. And God was very much involved in the actual direction they would take, the path that they would take, the route to the promised land, the land of Canaan, which is northeast of Egypt. Now, the quickest way to go would obviously be along the coast, straight up to the land of Canaan. But God didn't take them that way, as it says in Exodus chapter 13, because he did not want them to see war too soon. Now, archaeology has uncovered numerous installations, military installations from the period along the way of the Philistines, which it's called there in the Bible, which really does show that that's a fact. They would have seen war, a lot of war, on their way up to the Promised Land. So instead, God led them a different way, and instead he led them into a trap. By the wilderness of the Red Sea, that was the direction they were going to go. I'm sure you're familiar with this story, but today, or the day that this program is going to be live, the day that you're listening to it, is the last day of Unleavened Bread, when this eventual, or this wonderful miracle of the Red Sea took place. An absolute miracle. These waters parting, Israel going across on dry land, and the waters coming back together. Now, I'm not going to focus necessarily on that dramatic miracle. Instead, I'm focusing here on Egypt. On Egypt, and specifically the Egyptian military, and even more specifically, the Egyptian chariot. For in the Egyptian chariot and in the Egyptian military, we see the most powerful war machine that the world really had seen to that day. And it's easy to just belittle that, or belittle the army that was approaching the Israelites and why they were so fearful and afraid, even though they had seen numerous miracles from God already, all the plagues that fell upon Egypt. They had seen them, they had witnessed them, and they could get to the Red Sea, and it might be like, wow, why are they upset that the Egyptian army is coming? Don't they remember all those miracles? Well, you have to remember, this was the most powerful military force in the world, and they were being hunted by these chariots. That to them, or to us, I mean, it's impossible to compare it with a mobile military equipment to this day, but just imagine 600 plus tanks streaming towards you as a helpless man with your family. That would make you fearful. And the tank of the ancient world were these chariots in Egypt, as we'll see, had perfected their ability in warfare to use them in a way that would strike fear and terror in the hearts of the Israelites. And while Israel was going across the Red Sea and finally leave Egypt behind, God wanted to make sure that they also saw the Egyptian military that really was treated or given godlike status in ancient Israel, in ancient Egypt at this time. God wanted the Israelites to see that army destroyed as well. Well, let's just pick up the history here in Exodus chapter 14. Exodus chapter 14, in verse 1 to 7, I'm going to read from the King James Version. It says this, "And the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel that they turn and encamp before Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea over against Baal Zephon. Before it you shall camp, or it shall you encamp by the sea. For Pharaoh will say to of the children of Israel, they are entangled in the land. They're trapped, Pharaoh is going to say. In the wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart at that point, and he shall follow after them, and I will be honored among Pharaoh, or upon Pharaoh, and upon all his host, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Eternal." And they did so. It's interesting here. This is some of the same terminology that existed at the beginning of the plagues. And God said he brought them on them to show the Egyptians that God is the Eternal, that I am the Eternal. And here was the army that God was bringing into this to again show the Egyptians that God was the Eternal. Because this was the most powerful thing that existed on the planet physically, this army of Pharaoh. Verse 5 continues, "And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled, and the heart of the Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, Why have we done this? Why have we let Israel go from serving us? And he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. And he took 600 chosen chariots in all the chariots of Egypt and captains over every one of them." So we're introduced here to these chariots, chosen chariots, the choicest ones, and they were a symbol of Egyptian strength, this war chariot. Interestingly, these chariots, they weren't invented in Egypt, but were introduced by the Hyksos people who took over Egypt around 1700 BC. This was a few generations before the Exodus, but not too long. And then once Egypt was taken over by these new people, through largely use of this chariot or a style of the chariot, then the chariot was introduced into the Egyptian military manual, if you like. They took it, they reinvigorated its design, and they made it the essential part of its military. And it was on the back of the carriage of the Egyptian chariot that the military enlarged the empire of Egypt. Now, this would have been familiar to the Israelites. To us, we just hear the word chariot and it doesn't really strike fear in our hearts. But to the ancient Israelites and the ancient people of the lands around, the Egyptian army and the chariots of Pharaoh would have struck fear in them, like 1,000 of these Moab bombs. That's what it was like for the Israelites to be chased down by these people. Again, the chariot was the symbol of Egyptian military strength and dominance. Well, while, as I said, it didn't originate in Egypt, the Egyptians transformed it really from a weapon that was somewhat slow and cumbersome to one that was extremely fast and maneuverable. This chariot, especially when it got to Egypt, was a revolution in warfare. Their carriage was light, it was nimble. Of course, there would be two horses generally that were driving the carriage that were strapped together, and the carriage itself was light, could be picked up easily by one man, made of wood and leather generally, a bit of gypsum as well in the front that was wrapped around the carriage, and that was to hold generally two men. One of those would be the driver and the other one would be the archer. Now, we tend to think of a chariot in chariot charges and perhaps riding through a wall of men, but that very rarely happened, if not ever. The chariot was a vehicle for an archer to get close enough to fire arrows while it was traveling at speeds of up to 25 miles per hour, quite fast. That's a horse at its gallop, and then returning. And of course, you could carry far more of your arrows on the carriage, and you could also carry spears as they did. And this was the Bronze Age, of course, before iron was used in warfare. At this point, it was still bronze. And you could carry a whole lot more on one of these vehicles. But the Egyptians, again, changed the design over time. Now, how do we know? Well, in 1922, the tomb of Tutankhamun, one of the pharaohs from just after this period of the Israelites, was found. And inside of his tomb were six of his chariots. Why? Again, because the chariots were so important, symbolic of the power of Egypt. Now, PBS had a documentary in 2002 or 13. It was called Building Pharaoh's Chariots, the world's first high-performance vehicle. And it was very interesting to watch this because they recreated, following designs in ancient hieroglyphs and also designs and walls in different temples, different palaces in ancient Egypt, as well as the six that were dug up in Tutankhamun's tomb, they recreated today a couple of these chariots. And one of them, just one of them, took 600 man hours to produce. So this is a long time. It would take a long time for Egypt to produce these. And they had 600 of these choicest chariots that were with Pharaoh to hunt down the Israelites. Now, these wheels on them, they were created with six spokes. And very interestingly, that was an upgrade. First, they had four. But the four spokes didn't work so long. It produced a bit of a bumpy ride. So in order to disperse the pressure on the tire, they made it then with eight. And the eight spokes made it a little bit too heavy. So they went back to six spokes, at least what it seems. And that's what they kept through the next few hundred years. And each one of these spokes would be made from one piece of wood that was bent in half. That's right, bent in half. They saturate the wood with steam, and then they would bend it in a V shape. And then one of the sides of that V would be glued alongside another V, making one solid shaft. That would be your spoke. Two sides of a V attached together, and then the V would obviously go into the axle in the middle and pop back out as connected to the next spoke. So each one of these spokes is made from two V-shaped pieces of wood. If that makes sense. I'm sure you can Google this yourself if you wanted to. So these spokes, of course, would go obviously down to the very center of the tire that would be connected to and running along an axle as well. And this axle ran underneath the carriage. Initially, it was positioned right under the center of the carriage, but over time, this axle was moved further and further back towards the back of the carriage until it was right at the end of the carriage before the design stopped changing. Now, if the axle they found, obviously, anciently, if the axle was in the middle of the platform, it created for an extremely harsh ride because you would be feeling the brunt of whatever the tires hit. So the driver would be standing on a stiff, bouncing axle, and obviously this wouldn't work. So it made sense to move the axle backwards until it was right at the back of the carriage. Now, connected to that axle, or at least partially connected, it was a little bit loose on purpose, was an 8-foot pole that ran right underneath the carriage that the carriage would then sit on. This 8-foot pole was bent as well. It would be in an S shape to go underneath the carriage, then pop back up as it would go then right between the two horses and be connected to their harness. Now, what this would do was ensure that as the wheels bounced over difficult terrain, this wooden axle would flex and it would act kind of like a leaf spring, which would really soften the ride. Naturally, you would want to make the ride less bumpy so that you can go faster, and also so that it can be useful for firing arrows from. Again, that was the purpose. Firing arrows on the go was the purpose of these chariots. So to do that, you needed a kind of soft or flexible or shock-absorbed, if you like, ride. Then when it came to the bridle and the harness, the bridle was made in a certain way to keep the horses' heads down. The bridle went further down on the nose. This would shift the weight of the horses towards their back hind legs, and that would make the horses more agile and maneuverable so that they could make sharp turns. Now, these horses had to be thoroughly trained to work together. In this PBS documentary, it took them some time to work with these horses to try and get them to work in a way that functions together, to create the chariot in a way that the horses didn't get really annoyed by it. And what happened, it's quite stunning to watch how long it really took these cunning artificers of our day to recreate this chariot so that it could be used in battle and warfare. And they did. They took it out on different terrain. Finally, once they had spent the 600 man hours putting it together, following the ancient design, and one of the designers was saying how if you decided to give the same materials to a modern engineer, they couldn't do it better even today. They couldn't come up with a more effective, light, using the materials they had back then, vehicle. It was perfect. And really, one of the most graphic representations of the chariot belongs to the time of Thutmose III. He ruled around 1450 BC, around the exact time of the Exodus. He took over many territories. One such battle, when a lot of his chariots were used, was the Battle of Megiddo. One of the earliest recorded battles took place in northern Israel, and he had a chariot there that was covered in silver and gold, and this is what they called the Electrum Chariot. The Electrum Chariot. And on this PBS documentary, they recreated this Electrum Chariot. And this Thutmose III, again, he was a pharaoh right around the time of the Exodus. And so you can imagine him riding in this glistening gold and silver chariot. It was leaf, I believe. So it wasn't not to weigh it down because it had to be extremely fast. And this is what one Egyptologist said about these chariots. If there are a number of chariots coming towards you. Now, they didn't mention the Bible at all in this, but I thought that this quote was interesting because it says, this again is an Egyptologist was saying, the sight of it, the speed, the dust, the sound of it, the thunderous noise, it would be like the gods were attacking them. That's what it would be like in the Battle of Megiddo. That's what it would have been like for the Israelites, seeing the billowing cloud of dust rise in the horizon as hundreds and hundreds of these fast chariots, again, the tanks of their day, were heading towards them. I mean, as well as being a tremendous hit-and-run weapon, it would have been an enormous psychological weapon as well. The splendor, the noise, the dust cloud, it'd be absolutely terrifying. And I really do encourage you to go and watch this PBS documentary. Depending on where you are in the world, you could watch it for free. And it will really make this passage in Scripture come alive. And it will also bring out a facet to this passage of Scripture that I don't think we tend to focus on that much. That is, again, how much God was targeting the Egyptian army and the Egyptian chariot, the symbol of Egypt's strength, through this Red Sea experience. Now, with that in mind, we're going to read a few more verses. This is from verse 8 to 10 says this, and the Eternal hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and he pursued after the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with a high hand, but the Egyptians pursued after them all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them encamping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth and Baal-Zephon. And when it says horsemen there, it's good to remember it's just referring to those that were riding upon the chariots, because cavalry didn't actually exist at this point yet. They were just chariot riders as well as the army. And then it continues to write, verse 10 of Exodus chapter 14, and when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. They were terrified, absolutely terrified, as you would have been if you were there as well. And then, of course, we're going to have God that intervenes as Moses cries out to him, and he says, "Fear not, stand still, see the salvation of the Eternal. Speak to the children of Israel that they go forward." Go where? Go forward through the sea, and they would, verse 21, and Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Eternal caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea dry. And the waters were divided, and the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and unto the left, a wall they were. And the Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, even all of Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass that in the morning watch the Eternal looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of the cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians, and took off their chariot wheels, that they drove them heavily. Notice that? They were speeding through here at 25 miles an hour on the dry land that the Israelites had just walked through. And God attacks. He attacks their chariot wheels. Now, the Bible doesn't say anything about them getting stuck in the mud. I mean, the Israelites just went over there, just went over on dry land. And now we have the chariot wheels being attacked by God in some manner to the point that they could not go fast anymore, that they were swerving uncontrollably. The very mighty symbol of Egypt, the symbol of their strength, was being attacked by the mighty God, just like the plagues attacked the gods of the Egyptians previously. There was another one. There was another icon of Egypt that needed to be destroyed, not just so that the Israelites would see their deliverance, but that Egypt would see what? Well, let's read verse 25 again. And it says, and he took off their chariot wheels, which means he targeted them in some fashion, and they drove them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, at this point, the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel. For the Eternal fights for them against the Egyptians. That was the point here. Even the Egyptians could see, after fighting in numerous battles, if this was Thutmose III, I'm not saying it is, but if it was, I mean, he had fought numerous battles with his chariot army, been successful with his Electrum chariot of gold, of silver. And yet here he was facing off against the Israelites, or really the God of the Israelites. And when those chariots were attacked, they realized that the Eternal fights for Israel against the Egyptians. And then verse 26 says, and the Eternal said unto Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that their waters may come again upon the Egyptians, upon the chariots, and upon their horsemen. And that's what happened. And look over to the next chapter, and what do you read about? The celebration of God delivering them from Egypt, and also God delivering them from the army of the Egyptians, and specifically these chariots. In the end, that's what the material army of Egypt was good for. That was the strongest army of the day. That was the strongest army of the day, just as the American army today is the strongest army of the day. And yet, what did we see? God was against it. God was against that army. Obviously, the lesson here is put your strength in God. No physical army is going to be able to do it. Army's strength is only as good as the power that God allows it to have. We've come to the end now of today's program. Thanks again to Stephen Flurry for allowing me to take it. You can send your feedback, if you'd like to do that, to td@kpcg.fm, and that will reach Mr. Flurry. And until tomorrow, have a wonderful day.